So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center's Pinwheel Education Series on Concurrent Disorders. The Pinwheel Education Series is a monthly forum that brings together experts and persons with lived experience to talk about mental health and mental wellness. Everything related to the Pinwheel Series, including a recording of today's session, can be found at www.keltymentalhealth.ca/pinwheel. For those of you that are joining us for the first time, the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center is a provincial mental health and substance use information and resource center serving BC children, youth, and families. We also offer peer support to families and youth, as well as to people of all ages struggling with eating disorders. You can visit our website at www.keltymentalhealth.ca for more information, resources, and for our contact information. This month's Pinwheel Education Series is also a part of the Beyond the Blues Education and Screening Days, an annual mental health awareness campaign coordinated by CMHA BC and the Centre for Addictions Research of BC on behalf of the BC Partners for Mental Health and Addictions Information. Beyond the Blues events are held across BC in October and November with the aim of helping people learn the signs of depression and anxiety and related issues like mania, suicide, and risky drinking. So for more information about Beyond the Blues and for other events in your area, you can visit heretohelp.bc.ca/beyondtheblues. Okay, so we'll start with our first speaker. So Boyd, how do you say your last name? Folkard?
Folkard, yeah.
Folkard. So Boyd Folkard is a clinical counselor and the intake coordinator for the Provincial Youth Concurrent Disorders Program at BC Children's Hospital. He's been working with the team for the last 18 months, and he has been involved with the Children's and Women's Inpatient and Outpatient Psychiatry Department for the last 23 years. He's also worked with youth in various settings for the past 30 years. So welcome, Boyd, and go ahead.
I guess I'll just introduce the program to you and just to give you an idea of what we do. We're a tertiary level outpatient program serving youth ages 12 to 24 with complex needs associated with substance use and mental health concerns. The program provides a comprehensive assessments including diagnostic clarification and treatment recommendations, and limited treatment might also be provided if that's what the assessment kind of concludes. It was started in 2005 with one psychiatrist and one social worker. It now includes nurse clinician Jennifer Toomey is here, social work clinician Liz Kay, psychologist Colleen Allison, myself, and psychiatrist Dr. Carol Ansari. The bulk of our clients are between the ages of 16 to 22, but we've seen the whole age group from 12 to 24 at some point in time. The referral process is basically, we try to keep it pretty simple. Any medical doctor can make a referral, including general practitioners, psychiatrists, pediatricians, and nurse practitioners. And then a referral form is filled out that's available on the BC Mental Health, I think, website at this point in time. Mm-hmm. The criteria for this is evidence of current mental health symptoms, basically any kind of mental health concern, along with evidence of problematic substance use. Specifically, the clinic services include an assessment, and that in this area we do two types of assessment. One through the clinician that is a psychosocial assessment, and if needed or requested from the community, a psychiatric assessment with Dr. Carol Ansari. With a focus given to the role of substance use and its effects in mental health. The process of the assessment and consultation can take up to 5 appointments, lasting about an hour and a half. The outcome and recommendations will be discussed at the end in a feedback session, and this can include limited treatment at the clinic. The treatment modalities at the clinic primarily are cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, compassion-focused therapy, and motivational interviewing. Along with this is a program or a therapy called Seeking Safety, which PYCD was involved with research on trauma, and that will be published soon. The results of which informed our program that most of our clients have been affected by some form of trauma. And this led to the implementation of an evidence-based manualized treatment for trauma called Seeking Safety. The other services we offer are consultations to physicians and other healthcare providers around the province. And one way is achieved through a monthly teleconference. And the other type of things that we specifically do are diagnosis and diagnostic clarification, education that supports the family regarding concurrent disorders, acute and long-term medical and psychiatric effects of problematic substance use. We do medication consultation either through the clinic or through telephone consultations with doctors in around the province. We do resource consultation inter-hospital and through community contacts, and basically it's and the, one of the other things we do is we do a series of teaching to other healthcare providers in the community, and we provide student practicum.
So it's a great overview of the program. Thank you, Boyd. And so our next speaker is Jennifer Toomey. So she's the nurse clinician, as Boyd mentioned, and she's a registered psychiatric nurse who's been working with the Provincial Youth Concurrent Disorders Program since 2006. And she's been working in the field of concurrent disorders since the year 2000. And she has worked with both the adult population and the youth population in various roles. And she's also a busy mom of two young children and a dog. So welcome, Jennifer, and go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Azada. So concurrent disorders, what are they? So we define concurrent disorders as having two things going on, specifically mental health concerns as well as substance use concerns. And so these could be a variety of combinations. The most common one we see would be ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and marijuana use. But we see a broad range of mental health concerns, as Boyd talked about. We see everything from mood disorders to anxiety disorders, thought disorders like psychosis, trauma, like Boyd mentioned, and as a result of our research, it's the most common mental health concern that everyone seems to report that comes through our clinic. So they may have experienced trauma and also may have the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. We see the variety or the gamut of anxiety disorders, from social phobia to generalized anxiety disorder, OCD, and yeah, pretty much any kind of mental health concern, people can be referred if there's problems with anger, emotion dysregulation, sleep, we'll accept that. And like Boyd mentioned, one of our main services that we provide is diagnostic clarification, because quite often it's really clear there's some substance misuse or substance use concerns going on, but sometimes it's not so clear about the mental health issue. So then some people are like, well, chicken or egg, like what came first? So and with the concurrent disorders, it's, you know, there's a few ways that this can come about. So the most common that we see in our program is the substance use comes first. The substance use is used as a coping mechanism for the mental health issue. So the mental health concern has come first, and then people use substances to self-medicate or cope or to fit in. Sometimes people are using substances. For example, I worked with a girl that was using crystal meth as a stimulant to help control her weight and then ended up with psychosis. So using the substance can lead or exacerbate any kind of mental health concern that may be ongoing. We do see a lot of marijuana now connection to psychosis. That seems to be a big trend. Sometimes both of the problems can start independently. So you could have, say, someone with an anxiety disorder that gets involved in a car accident, and now they have post-traumatic stress disorder as a result, and they're using alcohol to self-medicate. So, and then find out, oh, the alcohol helps with my anxiety as well. And then sometimes they can start at the same time. I remember someone told me that they were just trying cocaine and that night had a panic attack and then now has a panic disorder. So yeah, so there's pretty much, I guess, four main ways you can come about having a concurrent disorder. We also know that there's an overlap in genetic vulnerabilities. So if substance use concerns and mental health concerns run in the family, there's a risk there that you may have one yourself, or if you were brought up in an environment where there was substance use and mental health, you know, you have, again, a higher risk for developing a concurrent disorder. And again, environmental triggers such as stress and trauma and early exposure to substance use put you at a higher risk for a concurrent disorder. Yeah, so the most common mental health or concurrent disorders that we have seen, and according to research out there, is conduct disorder at 74%. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, so 64%, and I'd say that's definitely what we see a lot of in our program. Then major depressive disorder at 53%, generalized anxiety disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder at 50%. And again, even though people may not meet criteria for PTSD, there's typically, usually trauma that has happened in the background. So youth, according to Stats Canada in 2003, youth were ages 15 to 24 were more likely to report suffering from mental health concerns and substance use concerns. And up to 60 to 80% of adolescents who had a substance use disorder also had a co-occurring mental health disorder. Up to 40% of youth that had a mental health concern also had a substance use concern. So as we can see, it's prevalent. It's pretty common, concurrent disorders. And this makes a lot of sense because when we look at the age of onset for mental health disorders, a lot of them start in childhood going through adolescence. So, you know, it makes sense. And then with our youth, like, why are we concerned? Well, a big reason is because of the developing brain. So whenever we're adding substances to the developing brain, we're having a greater risk at developing a substance use disorder. You're also interfering with the pathways, so affecting the development of the brain. With youth, it's pretty common that there's some dysregulation in emotion. So of course, everyone may suffer from or experience anxiety or depression. But with our youth, what we need to find out is this, you know, regular emotions that they're experiencing, or is this something that is leading to interfering with different parts of their life, such as school, family life, friends? Are they using substances to cope? If they are, then this could be what we would call a disorder. Risk-taking is definitely more common among our youth, so using or experimenting substances is pretty normal. What we know is that with youth, and so the brain develops from the back to the front, so the prefrontal cortex is where we get our decision-making abilities and impulse control and organization. And with youth, what we know is that if fun outweighs all the risks, they're going to do it. Why? Because it's fun. So we do know that that's, you know, part of how the adolescent brain is developed. And, you know, without that, then the youth wouldn't be taking some risk, which could be positive. For example, when we saw Dr. Osari present, she showed us some clips about a youth that was in a science lab. And because he was, you know, able to take risks without worrying about it, he came up with some pretty significant findings, I guess. I think it was in terms of something leading to cancer, so a medication for that. Whereas an adult, they would be worried about taking certain risks, you know, worried about what people would say or worried about failure. So there's definitely reasons why over, you know, that evolutionary, why the brain develops that way, and there's positive and then negative aspects of that. And we also know with youth that their substance use differs from adults. Typically, youth will binge. So according to Health Canada, a binge for a male is over five drinks an occasion, for a female over four. And with our youth, typically they'll describe buying a 26er of alcohol, then passing it around and taking shots, drinking alcohol quickly, then leading to blackout, and then leading, you know, to other high-risk behaviors. So if you're wondering, well, you know, okay, well, what about, you know, other reasons that youth would use substances? So according to the Macquarie Health Survey, the biggest one is that they just wanted to have fun. Other ones is that the friends were doing it. So we know peer pressure is a huge reason or a reason why youth would use substances. Stress, feeling down. So again, kind of that self-medicating piece. So there's many theories. And you know, a real big one that I have seen over the years is just feeling a sense of belonging, wanting to fit in. So what we also know about youth is that according to the McCreary study, the age of first use for youth with alcohol, drugs, and marijuana, which are still the top three substances that youth are using, is the average age of starting or trying it is 14. And some of the lower end, we've seen ages 10, 11 trying cigarettes. So, of course, there's that theory of gateway drugs. And, for us, we've seen that every youth that we've seen with substance use concerns, they've all started smoking cigarettes. But, of course, that's always up for debate. That's just what I've seen in my clinical practice, though. So, of course, with everything, there's risk factors. What we've seen is in the community, low social economical status. However, I've seen it go across the socioeconomic status from low to high, where people are suffering from concurrent disorders. They know that in early grades, in terms of education, if people are struggling, that can lead to a risk of mental health and substance use, as well as peer relationships. A family history of substance use, trauma in the childhood, those kind of things will all lead to risk factors. They've also looked at temperament, so if your baby is a bit more difficult or has higher in behavioral activity and impulsivity, those kind of things, could lead to concurrent disorder. And then, of course, with everything, there's protective factors. So what we've seen in research is that, temperaments that are resilient and people that are successful in their school and education, that's protective, as well as a positive social environment and a warm and supportive family. When we look at the continuum of substance use, so I have a diagram here, it's like an inverted triangle, and at the top is, so abstinence. So this is kind of looking at the population in general. So the majority of the population in the world don't use substances. Then of course there's experimental, so trying something once or twice, going into social, so using maybe once a week and it's connected to a social activity, whether that's a glass of wine with dinner. Then more moving into habitual, so now you have to be smoking marijuana every time you go to the movie with your friends, or we're gonna play golf, who's getting the beer? So these activities tied together. And then abuse, so that's where we would look at, if there's problems being caused by the substance, such as problems, academic performance, or problems with friendships, family, etc., into dependence or addiction. So the DSM-5 in the past, we used to have substance abuse and then substance dependence, and now it's all substance use disorder. So there's 11 criteria, and if you meet two or more, then that would indicate a substance use disorder. So when we're looking at a substance use disorder, are you using the substance for a longer period of time than intended, or are you using a larger amount than you're planning to? Are you having some social problems as a result of your substance use? Do you have cravings or urges to use? Have you developed a tolerance? Do you need more to achieve the same high or experience that you're looking for? Are there withdrawal symptoms related to your substance use? So for example, the hangover with alcohol the next day, are you experiencing problems with sleep or upset stomach, those kind of things. With marijuana, it's a bit tricky because the THC attaches to your fat cells, so withdrawal symptoms wouldn't occur until 4 or 5 days after you used. And those symptoms would be irritability, problems with sleep, appetite changes, etc. So because it occurs a while after, people don't usually put it, oh, it's because I smoked marijuana on the weekend. Yeah, so also having persistent efforts to cut back and being unsuccessful is a criteria for a substance use disorder, and using despite physical or psychological consequences. So if you're asking yourself, well, how would I know if a youth I work with or a youth that I know or my son or daughter may have a substance use or a mental health concern? Well, what we know is that there could be, you could notice that maybe your youth is more isolated, withdrawn, frequently depressed or hostile. There could be a change in academic performance, a change in appearance, a change in peer group, missing classes more at school, getting in trouble with the law, changes in eating and sleeping habits. So those kind of things could tip you off that there could be something else going on. And when we work with people with concurrent disorders, there's challenges in identifying it, because the substance use can mimic a mental health issue. The substance use can exacerbate or, you know, initiate a mental health issue. Substance use can also mask a mental health issue. We know that withdrawal can cause or mimic symptoms of a mental health issue. And yeah, that psychiatric behaviors can also mimic a substance use disorder. So you're asking yourself, how do I figure this out? Well, at our program, we use the ASAM, which is the Addiction or American Society for Addiction Medicine. There's six dimensions, and we use that as a framework. So the first dimension is intoxication or withdrawal potential. So when we're seeing someone, we keep that in mind, like, what are you using? When was the last time you used? How much you are using? The dimension number two is biomedical condition. So what's going on for them physically? How's their eating patterns? How's their sleep? Dimension number three, so looking at the mental health symptoms or concerns. Dimension four, assessing their stage of change. Do they want to accept treatment? Are they ready to look at mental health or their substance use? So making sure you know what stage of change they are in for both, because quite often it's different. And then likewise, the family is usually in an absent stage of change for their youth to change, and the youth may not be there. Most of the time, the youth, they may be pre-contemplative, not thinking that they have a problem with substances, but maybe open to looking at their depression and vice versa. So it's very important to assess the stage of change. Therefore, you know what kind of strategy to put in place for that. We also look at the recovery environment, so what's going on in the family, what's going on at school, and then we assess the relapse potential. So by breaking it down, it makes something really complicated. You know, at least it gives us a starting point, so it works as a good framework. The good news is mental health and substance use concerns are treatable. So in our program, like Boyd already mentioned, psychosocial treatments could be family therapy, individual therapy, doing group therapy. Like Boyd already mentioned, cognitive behavioral therapy is effective. Using motivational interviewing as a style of counseling works really well with our youth. And then, you know, if all of these other skills and those kind of things have not worked, then we'll look into medication. So yeah, so and I guess that takes us to, you know, if you do have any, we see youth from around the province, so if there is someone that you're working with or you have a son or daughter that you're concerned about and you've tried the community services already, then the Provincial Youth Concurrent Disorder is another service you can try. So we are a tertiary level service, which means that people have had to try their community or secondary primary level of service first. And that's about it.
Okay, thank you, Jennifer. That was very comprehensive. So speaking of community, we have someone from the community here to speak next. So I'll just introduce her first. So Lindsay Grenier has spent the last 10 years working with young people and their families who are struggling with substance use and mental health in a variety of settings, from youth detox and supported recovery to residential treatment. She's currently working as a youth and young adult counselor with Vancouver Coastal Health's Youth and Family Substance Use and Concurrent Clinical Counseling Program, and has been a member of this team for 4 years, providing support primarily to those in the Broadway Commercial Corridor. Lindsay was born at St. Paul's, raised in the Greater Vancouver area, and has what her partner confirms to be a healthy obsession with French bulldogs. So, welcome, Lindsay, and go ahead.
Thank you. That's a really long program name. It's a fairly recent change that we've kicked around for quite some time, and so I can see on some people's faces, they're like, wow, that's quite the name. And I think I'll probably speak just briefly to why we changed the name and changed the title to Concurrent. And a lot of that had to do just with wanting to reflect the work that we were already doing with young people. When you just say addictions counselor, it has people kind of stuck feeling like that's all we deal with, when in fact that's not the case. Not only are we dealing with the whole person, including mental health issues that are coming up for them, but we're also trained to deal with that kind of stuff as well. And so we really wanted to sort of dispel that myth of the kind of work that we were doing, so that part of that was to sort of decrease the confusion for people in the community too who are accessing services, so they didn't have to jump around quite as much to or think that they needed to also find mental health support for their young person. So that's sort of why that came about. And then I guess just in general, our program, so we're in the community, we work with young folks who are 13 to 25, that's kind of our age out, is at your 25th birthday. There is some leeway around that. If things sort of weren't quite wrapped up at 25, we're not going to sort of say, see you later, have a nice life. We want somebody to be in a good place before they're going to transition them onto a different kind of service, perhaps in the adult world. So we see young people, and we also see their families, and who are the term substance affected other, sort of one that gets tossed around. But so we really like to work with the whole family if it's possible, because we find that that is a much easier way to affect change in a young person's life. Mm-hmm. And whatever that family looks like, whether that's their biological family, their adopted family, their street family, their partner, or their friends, whoever sort of their supports in their world, we're absolutely open to supporting as well in our counseling practice. So we're long-term counseling. We don't have a fixed number of sessions. That being said, we obviously don't want young people to feel like they're stuck in counseling for the rest of their lives. So we're very encouraging of wanting to build up people's abilities and their coping skills and their having them launch and move forward with their lives at some point. So that's just something that sometimes people think that they're going to be stuck in counseling forever, and that's hopefully not going to be the case. So, like I said, 13 to 25 young folks and their families, and we, so it's long-term. We do assessment in that work, and often are very closely linked with other programs like the Provincial Youth Concurrent Disorders Program for the assessment piece, because at this time we actually don't have access to sort of consistent psychiatry. So we're working on that, obviously, but we definitely do have very close partnerships with other agencies locally, whether that's, I personally have a really great working relationship with the Northeast Mental Health Team, and their psychiatrist there will see some of my young people, and I'll be the clinician that they'll be sort of referring back to in the community. And so that's been a lovely partnership, and it actually means that my clients get to see them quicker, because they're not waiting for a clinician on the mental health team at times, because that's sort of where the backup can sometimes occur in that system. So we offer some groups at times. It sort of varies, so you'd have to call and sort of check in when or not we've got groups happening. We do individual work and family work, and a ton of different kind of modalities. We're really client centered, so it's really what's going to fit best for that person. And we'll sort of bounce around until we make sure that we find something that fits. We're not just going to only stick to one modality just because that's what someone said is going to be effective. If it's not effective with the person in front of us, then we got to change what's going on to make it work. And I think that most programs are sort of operate from that vantage point, clients first. So I'm trying to think of other things that are important about our program. Would be referrals come straight to each one of us. So the way that we operate is we are in multiple community health centers across the Vancouver area. And so we're sort of located neighborhood based just to decrease barriers to accessing care for our young people and their families. So we've got someone out in the west side in Carisdale at Pacific Spirit Community Health Center. We've got another person downtown at Three Bridges, which is sort of in the west end a little bit. We've got someone on the downtown east side. We've got myself and another colleague of mine. We work out of Robert and Lily Lee, which is commercial on Broadway. Out at Evergreen, which is sort of way, way east on Boundary. There's another person, and then we have one more counselor centered right in the middle at Ravensong, which is sort of Main and Broadway area. So we've got a pretty good sort of coverage for the entire city. That being said, we don't refer based on boundaries. So if you have somebody who thinks it's going to be really easy to get to Broadway Commercial because it's an intersection for transit, but they live in a different place in the city, or they're going to school there or something like that, we're totally open to that referral coming to us instead of where they live. Whatever works really is kind of our mandate for that kind of stuff. And you would just call us directly. There's no centralized intake. You're dealing directly with the clinician. We don't carry a wait list at this time. So often we're seeing our clients within a 2-week period, which is really fantastic in this day and age. There's lots of wait lists out there. That being said, we're also open to sort of checking in and seeing whether we're the most appropriate service for people. We're happy to sort of consult and kind of kick around some ideas with folks just to make sure that, the worst thing about coming into this system is that it's complicated. And we're just really about trying to decrease the confusion about what's the most appropriate. Sometimes I get parents who call 5 different people and they're just so frustrated by the time they get to us. And so just, we're happy to sit, and if it's not us, we're going to tell you exactly who we think would be the best fit and try and get them connected to that person as quickly as possible. So that's our access. Referrals come from anybody, really. You can self-refer. They sometimes come from provincial youth. Mm-hmm. They sometimes come from probation officers. They come from schools. They come from youth clinics, GPs, concerned friends, families. You name it, and they're really, the process is super simple. As long as the person is interested in coming in and talking to us, because we're not a mandated service, it's voluntary completely, then we'll talk to them. And we'll talk to people just about, what's going on for you, and it doesn't need to mean that we're going to continue meeting with you, but we're open to sort of just even sitting down with a young person, talking about what's going on, and so they know who we are, so that if later on they feel like they need some support, then they know where to find us. We're happy just to support families too, so if a parent doesn't know what the heck to do, then we can just provide support to that parent or connect them with the right people to do that ongoing work if they're not feeling like it's a great fit for them. I think if there's other things that's important to know.
Are there other similar programs across BC that you know of?
For sort of similar to us?
Yeah.
As far as I know, yes, there are localized mm-hmm. supports usually. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, you might be able to speak a little better to that.
Yeah, the Frasers definitely. I know there's Surrey Addiction Services and Langley and Maple Ridge Alouette Addiction Services. So they do have addiction services for each health authority. And I know that Vancouver Island, again, they have mm-hmm. services as well. I understand from up north there's services, but very limited. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't think that they have probably the nice coverage like Vancouver does of all the different neighborhoods. Yeah. They have it for Surrey, and Surrey is very huge, but mm-hmm. just one clinic there. So, that's what I'm.
And then just in terms, I guess, in terms of the people that we're seeing, the young people and their families, that's another thing I think that's probably worth. We see people on the entire spectrum. Like we get a lot of parents who are really concerned because their young people are just starting to experiment. And so all five alarms are being rung in the family home. And, you know, it's sort of talking to parents about how to stay involved enough so they can tell when their young person is maybe transitioning from something that's experimental and fairly frequent in this day and age to something that's more problematic. But we definitely would sit with a young person who's, you know, experimentally using, but finding that maybe their peer group is sort of going down that path of using more regularly and they're worried about it, right up to young folks who, you know, are, you know, have lost their housing and are on the street now and are using daily, and that's become the entire focus of their lives. I would say that, you know, in terms of where our service sits, we would be sort of the service where we need some kind of substance use in order for the young person to be involved. And so it would be substance use, and they can also have the mental health piece happening. I'd say that what usually happens is we might get connected and find out our young person really needs some serious mental health supports, which are better serviced by another program. So an example of that might be that we start working with the young person and we realize that they're really dealing with some kind of psychosis. And so knowing that we're not necessarily equipped to deal with that part of their journey, we might connect them with the early psychosis intervention program in order to have that sort of part of their care well looked after. And so we're very good at sort of assessing that and making sure that we're not taking on something that would be harmful to that young person's care in terms of getting them what they need. I'm always happy to sort of see somebody until we figured out what's going on and then make sure we're connecting them up with the most appropriate services. But if you sort of thought of things on like a spectrum of like substance use and mental health, and it's really serious substance use with some mental health, that's definitely us. But if it was all the way over here, it's very serious mental health with some substance use concerns, then it might be better to sort of connect them with somebody who's got a more robust mental health sort of focus, with a team, a psychiatrist, medication management, and those kinds of things. You know, that's not to say that at some point that young person might not come back to us to do that long-term counseling piece, especially for young people who are aging out of the child youth mental health service sphere. So because we see young people right up to 25, you know, that's a huge bonus for that population of young people, because at 19 they age out of a lot of the mental health supports that are available to them. And so we see a lot of 19 to 24 year olds as a result of that, because their services have kind of gone poof, even though they are still very much in need of supports. And because our adult system in the mental health world is not set up maybe to take on young people who might have anxiety or ADHD as their primary diagnosis, then they really are without supports at that moment, because they can't transition into the adult world. The adult mandate looks more at very serious, chronic, persistent sort of mental health that's kind of characterized by schizophrenia, psychosis, you know, high suicidality with very complex depression and those kinds of diagnoses. And so then you get your young person who is struggling with intense anxiety and can't even get out of their house, but they don't have a mental health team anymore to support that. And so, you know, we're definitely going to be one of those primary services that would sort of look at trying to support that young person through that difficult transitionary period. And then I think we could totally piggyback really briefly on some of the trends that Jennifer had talked about. We see the exact same thing. I see so much trauma for our young people, and especially our young women. Lots of trauma, and a lot of it is related to assaults out there. And so that's a really, really difficult. And then coupled with that, lots of anxiety that comes up related to the trauma. They kind of go really hand in hand for our young people. But then also just anxiety in general, a lot of it. And then in terms of what young folks are using, it sort of runs the gamut. You know, if they're still connected to school, often it's drinking and alcohol, or drinking and cannabis, marijuana. But if they're sort of less connected with school, I often see a much bigger increase in sort of the intensity of the drugs that they're using, whether that's MDMA and ecstasy or heroin and opiates to crystal meth. So it's sort of, I think of my caseload and it's sort of all there at this point. And it sort of seems the less connected they are to home and school, the more intense some of that drug use has become for them as a real sign of like, no supports, really needing a coping mechanism. And that's the easiest thing to access for a young person who will have a lot of supports out there, right? So, does that feel like
Great. Okay. Thank you so much, Lindsay. So last but not least, our final speaker is Pablo Botero. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So Pablo has been attending the Concurrent Disorders Program since 2007. He is currently in remission from substance dependency and abuse, but continues to work through longstanding mental health issues. So welcome, Pablo. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about your journey with kind of mental health challenges and substance use, so how you kind of ended up here.
All right, sure. So I guess I'll kind of start with my introduction and diagnoses, or my understanding of it. Currently, I am in remission from substance abuse and substance use. That is, I'm not using regularly. If anything, it's maybe smoking cigarettes and drinking a little bit too much on occasion. But I've definitely kind of run the gamut, and it's kind of funny listening to you speak, actually, and saying that when there is no support, that the drug use and intensity does increase. It was very much the same for me. However, I did not necessarily start with binge drinking or using marijuana. For me, it was actually LSD and ecstasy that I started using. Everything else kind of came after, but definitely by the time I dropped out of school, I'd been kicked out of my house. I was losing my jobs and all that kind of stuff. I was dependent on heroin, injecting, and just that was my life. So I guess let's kind of start with my, should I start with a history of what I think mental health?
Sure.
All right. So if I recall back to my childhood, I know for a fact that I was dealing a lot with anxiety. In terms of where it came from, it's really hard to understand other than perhaps it's run in the family. There has been suicide and depression, psychosis and all that, that is pretty relevant to my family. And I was dealing with anxiety as a kid, which dealt with a lot of social isolation, some physiological problems growing up as well. Definitely a lot of problems with mood and depression. I wasn't able to sleep. I would say things like I wanted to die, or I would not go to school, or act like I was sick so that I could stay out of school. And essentially what that kind of led to was just me having to bounce around through the mental health system, as well as, I guess, the institution, which is health in general. It never really came to any conclusive, or the goal was always to find some sort of conclusive evidence as to what I was diagnosed with, and not so much with dealing with the everyday problems that I was struggling with. So being told constantly that I had a problem, and being removed from school, and from certain groups, and being not being able to do some things that other kids were doing, definitely was a form of trauma for me, especially because it was both the system as well as my school, as well as my family telling me that I had a problem, but not necessarily ever telling me what was wrong, or how to cope with it or how to solve it. So that was kind of ongoing through my childhood, and then I kind of transitioned into my teens, where I started getting more of a sense as to who I was. I started dealing more with identity issues. I guess in my teens, I definitely kind of like, I can't remember who was saying, but change in appearance, change in friend groups, change in like behavior, isolation, that whole bit was really relevant to me at the time. Definitely my mood and depression and anxiety flared up at that time, especially because all of a sudden, at that age, you become very self-aware, and you realize that other people do see you, and what you do does affect the world around you. And so you kind of become hyper-aware, and that in itself causes a lot of anxiety. And that coupled with, I guess, my childhood kind of just made it a really confusing time in my life. At that time, I had started experimenting with self-harm. I also started engaging in damaging interactions with my family, my peers, and I guess the system around me and institutions, so school, the law, etc. Yeah, so that was kind of a stage, and then that was maybe when I was about like 12 years old. By the time I was 13, that's when I kind of started experimenting with smoking cigarettes, as well as drinking. Not so much as a social behavior, but more as I was having a sleepover, and I'd be at a sleepover with my friends, and I'd get very anxious, and so I'd actually go into the booze closet and drink that. I'm not too sure where I learned that behavior, but definitely because it was kind of under the rug and unexpected, I was able to do that for quite a while. And all my friends thought it was funny, and I was uninhibited, and so it's just kind of how it went. So moving into my mid-teens, so around 2006-2007, was when everything kind of just really did blow up. I'd spent the summer working, which was great for me because I learned a lot of skills, but it also meant that I had a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It also was a time where I had a lot of time. So I guess throughout that summer, I started experimenting with LSD, ecstasy, marijuana. That started becoming a daily thing. That eventually transitioned into ketamine, GHB, and methamphetamine. And then it's kind of the time that I was referred to Jennifer. And kind of moving on from there, I dropped out of school. I went into a do-it-yourself program, which was great because I managed to keep my job and sustain myself. Because at that point, I had been kicked out of school. My parents were not letting me come home intoxicated. I wasn't allowed to see certain people. So that kind of leniency in that space was really beneficial to me to kind of, one, be independent, but also to be able to live the life that I was leading without necessarily hitting barriers that would just propagate the issue even more than what it was. Instead, it kind of let me do my life as it was, and with the time that I did have, maybe deal with the issues that were coming up. So that was great. And definitely in that time, I started using opiates and heroin, injecting opiates and heroin when I was 14, 15, I think. And then that went on until I was 17, and that whole part of my life was pretty much just using going to school when I could and working. That was pretty much all I was doing. And in that life as well, you start getting into a lot of situations that are quite traumatic. And so it's kind of this cycle where you're doing something, or I guess you're coping with trauma, but you're also putting yourself in a situation in which there is more trauma, mm-hmm. in which you're susceptible to more of it as well. And so it just kept on going from there, and that really did affect me up until now, particularly. And kind of in my late teens, when I was about to graduate, I'd actually been attending school quite regularly. Well, I wasn't attending regularly, but I was doing what I had to. But I definitely starting to see some of my friends pass away, starting to see people disappear off the radar, starting to lose pretty much any support that I had around me. At that time, I really felt like I had to run away, and drugs weren't quite doing it. By that time, I'd also overdosed, so I had my first experience with that, which was quite traumatic. And also being with friends who, just completely passed out and having to go to the hospital with them and being told that I'm a bad person because I'm a user and I enabled this, blah, blah, blah. My escape was just kind of to leave flat out, and so I actually moved to Powell River. So, hi y'all, Powell River. And I enrolled myself into the high school there, and I was living by myself and was suddenly responsible for my groceries, for going to school and doing all that bit. And that definitely was quite a switch from what I was living before, and it was quite exciting for me, to be honest. So at that time, I was quite productive, and I really did feel like I was doing the right thing. And so from there, I kind of continued traveling. I ended up going to the East Coast of Canada. And I was pretty much gone from Vancouver for a full year without any contact with any of my old friends, without any of my old peer groups, any of that. And so that was great. But then came the time where I had to come back. I guess come back to reality, because you can only stay on the road for so long. And so coming back here was kind of, it was quite nerve-wracking. I remember definitely speaking with my peers at the time in the East Coast about the implications of me going back to the place that I physically left to escape all trauma and to escape substance issues, all that kind of stuff. And anyway, so I ended up coming back mostly because I wanted to go to post-secondary, because of course that's a pressure for most people to do once they're finished high school. And so I came back here and I definitely isolated myself socially. I started exercising really hard. I'm a bicycle mechanic, so I was riding my bike all the time, like ditching school if I felt too stressed just to ride my bike, or swimming. And I was also working quite a bit. So I was in school in a full-time program, as well as working two jobs and just staying, ignoring everything that was around me and kind of ascribing myself to goals that other people were making for me. So that in itself was a form of denial that I came to understand later. When last year I got injured, I was riding my bike and I got hit by a car. And so all of a sudden I was unable to exercise, I was unable to go to work. I was unable to use all the coping mechanisms that I had gained. And also with that came all of the, everything that I was dealing with by ignoring, all of a sudden swole up because I was essentially in bed and unable to move for 3 months. Well, I was able to move, but it wasn't very comfortable. And kind of looking back, evidence as to the fact that I was ignoring those things was that I wasn't able to hold meaningful relationships. So that's with my family, with my friends, as well as an intimate relationship. I'd not been able to do that prior because I was just so stressed all the time. I was unable to solve stressful situations. I would ignore them largely and cope with them with exercise as well as just work. And substance abuse as well, where although I wasn't using regularly, if something bad did happen, I would use to the point of passing out, or I would use to the point of starting to get psychotic kind of emotions and thoughts. So anyway, from that injury, as both being depressed and anxious and having that come up, I was also prescribed, what's it called?
You're prescribed an antidepressant.
Prior to that, I was prescribed an opiate to deal with pain.
Oxycodone.
And so I kind of had this weird intersection where I was dealing with old problems, and all of a sudden I was given the ability to medicate in the same way that I was medicating prior to leaving. Last year I started abusing my Oxycontin for about a week, and I got called out by my parents. My parents freaked out, got my doctor to call me, tell me that I had a problem. My parents yelled at me, took everything away from me, said I have to stay in my room, like totally went into panic mode. And that just like completely flipped the radar for me, where like all of a sudden I was depressed to the point where like I was hearing things, I was unable to look people in the eye, I refused to leave my room, I was definitely out there, kind of because I was in that very, that was just the situation I ended up in. And so I got prescribed pharmaceuticals to deal with depression and anxiety for the first time. And that's Wellbutrin and Sertraline?
Yeah, Sertraline.
Which worked great for the first month or two, because it did really, although it did cause anxiety and strange emotions for me, it did sedate me quite a bit and did let me kind of rest at home, recovering from my injury, but also being able to be at like mental ease for the most part. But that was prescribed to me by my doctor, my family physician, who then wanted to take me off of it almost immediately because he thought it was just to deal with the fact that I was just sitting at home all the time. At that point, I asked to be referred back to concurrent disorders because I did kind of realize that those two things were happening at the same time. I also didn't want to be taken off my medication because it was working quite well. I was able to overcome my social anxiety. I was able to hold more meaningful relationships so far as getting an intimate relationship that was actually meaningful for the first time. I was able to deal with stress. And so anyway, I re-referred myself back. I had a struggle, of course, with my family physician, but yeah. So I've been attending concurrent disorders for the last year. I didn't think I was going to come back, but it happens that way sometimes. And we've been working through seeking safety as well as just keeping up to date with my medication. And that seeking safety is dealing with a lot of the trauma that I experienced, particularly when I was using, but also trying to understand why I was using substances to cope with trauma from before. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. So
that's great. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That was fantastic. So I know that we're a bit short on time, so I want to make sure we have time for questions. And I'll leave the room last because we're all physically here, so we can ask questions. So for you folks in telehealth in Powell River, if you have any questions, you can just unmute yourselves. Does anyone have any questions?
Hi. What about, do you deal with disabilities at all? So we have a dual diagnosis team that's coming up here right soon. So this is why it's a little bit sort of in my head. But how often do you see you talk about the concurrent disorders. What about if you have a disability thrown into that? So FASD or autism or things like that?
Typically, those folks would go to the dual diagnosis program here. I think it's West Coast. So we really focus on the mental health piece as well as the substance use concerns. We have seen folks with FASD and autism in the past, but yeah, I guess depending on the severity of both of those concerns would determine if we would see them or if West Coast would.
Right, so even if they don't have an official diagnosis, what happens then? Because not all kids have the diagnosis of FASD.
Yeah.
So when you're trying to use cognitive behavioral therapy stuff with a child who has difficulty with that, do you struggle with that, or is that something that it just kind of worked out?
Yeah, well, we haven't done cognitive behavioral therapy with someone with FASD or autism that I'm aware of. Yeah, we would probably refer to the community. We have the Center for Ability here in Vancouver, so I guess it would depend on the resources that are specific. But we have seen people, say, with FASD that weren't diagnosed.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have seen that. Yeah.
And in the community, I'd say that definitely we see those folks and support them the best that we can if that's the service that they're wanting. So just making sure that we explain what we can do and and trying to figure out whether it's going to work for them, because you're right, the CBT is not going to be awesome for someone who's maybe struggling with some pretty significant barriers as a result of FASD, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but that doesn't necessarily mean that doing a bunch of case management and a bunch of support and getting the right people in the place isn't almost more important than that in the beginning, to get them some stability and just to create that stability that allows them to at least get what they can from a counseling experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I know for a fact, that I've had clients who have struggled with it, and that other colleagues also, and it wouldn't be something that would preclude them from accessing our service, for sure.
Yeah, and with our service, we would be making, when we do our assessment and we do our feedback and recommendations, then in the recommendations piece, we would be all about linking them to the service that would meet their needs.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons that we outlined was appropriate referral would be for diagnostic clarification. So if it's suspected that there's something on board but it's not confirmed, it would be an appropriate referral, and that feedback and treatment recommendations would come out of that. So if that's if there's nobody around to provide the service and the diagnosis, then it would be totally appropriate to refer them to our program and get that clarification if there's substance use concerns on board as well, right?
Right, yeah.
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 And we can do that, I don't know, through telehealth as well. I know you're in Powell River, so I don't know what the access is like up there, but.
Pretty limited.
Do you have telehealth?
Yeah, we do.
Okay. So that would be a service that we could provide through our clinic as well.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, we have that. We deal with Sunny Hill, actually.
Okay, there you go.
Yes, the team that from there will do it up here with them, some of the families, yeah.
Yeah. So that is something that could be organized if you had someone up there that you wanted seen by our clinic. We just go through, I guess, the telehealth people here, and they work it all out. So, yeah, but it's like Boyd said, it's an option.
Something happens.
Yeah,
somebody does something.
I know I got a video camera on my computer in my office that I got scotch tape on, but
yeah.
Okay, so I'm just going to open it up to the phone. I realize we're a bit over time here. I just want to give folks on the phone an opportunity to ask questions if they have them.
I actually was wondering, like, is there like a specific program for adults with concurrent disorders, or is it just like whatever's out there, like mental health wise, and then treatment for substance use? Is there anything that's like what you guys do?
Yeah,
that's a really good question, because in Vancouver we had the Center for Concurrent Disorders that worked with adults, and they have closed. So what they've done as a result of that, Lindsay, you may be able to answer that better.
Mm-hmm. So all of the addiction counselors that work in the adult teams are all technically concurrent. So they would be able to do both of that. And they're embedded in teams that have addiction doctors on them, addiction physicians, as well as addiction nurses. And so together they could probably come up with a pretty accurate diagnosis through that. Mm-hmm. Or often what ends up happening is if folks are connected to that concurrent counselor, there may be a referral to outpatient psychiatric at Vancouver General Hospital. Mm-hmm. And to sort of confirm diagnoses if a person's interested in that, and then continue to do that counseling piece with the concurrent counselor on the adult team. Does that sound okay?
Yeah.
Okay, and there was another question on telehealth?
I'm just wondering what you suggest when you, for a person that is, they're 19 years old, and they already have diagnoses and opiate dependencies and whatnot, but they're not willing to help themselves. So they're not, they've already gone through, you know, like they're, I know, don't laugh. so many people are in this position where they just won't help themselves.
And you know what I'd say is, like with the most important, the relationship is the most important to any kind of treatment. So if the person is in a space where they don't want help, and just being allowing or letting that person know that you are there for when they are ready to get help could be helpful. So, and just, you know, that person would be pre-contemplative. So according to the stages of change, establishing a rapport, being warm and respectful, giving information with permission, those kind of things. But it's really challenging. But unfortunately, with the way things work, people have to get to a point, unless they are decompensating and are a threat to themselves or others, then they could be certified. But other than that, it's challenging to watch some people make some pretty serious choices that negatively affect their health and their being.
So the experience that I have is this person tried to kill themselves and then was in the hospital and just refused any counseling or anything and so was discharged. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a very young, vulnerable person who is homeless, jobless, has no money, you know, the whole thing.
Right, yeah.
And it's very suicidal.
I think it would be actually really useful if you called the Kelty Center, and I don't know if you have connected with the Kelty Center before. Yeah, so we have peer support workers who would be able to kind of help navigate the system a little bit and offer some support, peer support specifically. That's something that we hear a lot. So I think it would be really useful to give the Kelty Center a call. I think tomorrow would be the best because we'll have our parent in residence there who has lots of experience in this area. And I would definitely highly recommend calling the Kelty Center to kind of help through that process.
Okay, thank you.
And I would just like, my experience is there's a lot of that out there and it's just sort of hanging on to whatever relationship that you have with that person until they get there. It's probably the worst part about this job is watching their lives deteriorate. It's really hard on service providers, but it's kind of essential because they're gonna hit something that's gonna make it not worth it anymore. And if they don't have that connection anymore, then they may do something really drastic like attempt again, because they don't know where to go. So it's really just about keeping those lines of communication open and just consistent messaging of anytime you want anything, like I always just start with basics, like, you know, like I'll get you bus tickets back and forth so you can just come and sit in my office for an hour. I don't care what you do.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't, and to really just push that it's like, I'm never gonna tell you that you have a problem. I'm not gonna tell you what to do. I'm just going to be there. And so you don't need people telling you what to do. I get it, you're doing your own thing right now. And so if you can kind of just always have that consistent message and keep that open, at some point they're gonna get that, you know, and it's gonna be meaningful to them. It's just, you have to be there when it becomes meaningful, because otherwise then you've got trouble, right? So.
And I just would, if we have time, I was just gonna say, you know, people change. There's pretty much three reasons, you know, a major event happens that, you know, causes them to change, like a motor vehicle accident, someone dies of cancer, kind of like a buildup of stressors can cause someone to change. So whenever kind of, if we're looking at a balance here, the negatives outweigh the positives, that will spark change. And also, but as a clinician, what you could do is something like a decisional balance graph. So looking at the positives of what they're doing, the negatives of what they're doing, the positives of changing that behavior, and the negatives of changing that behavior, because sometimes just kind of weighing those things out can cause some people that can tip that scale over and wanting them to change. And like Lindsay said, if you have a relationship, then they know they can come to you for the support and for guidance to help change.
Okay, and I'm just gonna, sorry, was there anyone else on the phone that had any questions? I think if you have questions and you didn't get a chance to ask, you can just email the Kelty Center and I'm happy to forward the questions to our speakers. For those of you that are left and that are here in the room, did you have questions for our speakers?
I just have one. I was just wondering what conduct disorder is.
Yeah, you said conduct disorder is the number one. What does that mean?
Right, so conduct disorder is a mental health issue in child and youth development. And so you have to meet a bunch of criteria. Those criteria are, you know, breaking the law, harming animals, not listening to authority. So it's in the DSM-5. With that stat, as I was reading that, a lot of people could look like they have conduct disorder when they're active in their addiction.
Yeah.
So they may be stealing, they may be doing something, things they would normally not do.
Yeah.
So by the time, you know, they stop using, then conduct disorder may not even be on the radar.
Yeah.
They could have been someone that, you know, loves animals or listens and doesn't break the law. So yeah, it's a good question. But yeah, when I saw that, I was like, you know, I wonder if that stat was taken while some people were using, because quite often it can look like one thing, But once someone has stopped using, that's completely not what's going on.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's more information about conduct disorder on the Kelty website as well. Okay, so we've gone way over time. I think it's time to bring this to a close. So thank you, everyone, so much. Thank you so much to our speakers. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.